am I? It's a question, a fundamental question, one of those fundamental questions that everyone encounters at some point in their lives as we search for meaning, as we search for purpose, as we search for understanding of ourselves and our relationship to this world that we live in. We want to know who we are and consequently how we fit into this world. It's a question that author James Smith has sought to answer, and you don't have to read his book to discover his conclusion. He puts it right in the title, right in the cover, "You Are What You Love." You are what you love. He expounds a little bit more in a second book, Desiring the Kingdom. He says, we are what we love, and what we love is a specific vision of the good life, an implicit picture of what we think human flourishing looks like. Thus, we become certain kinds of people. We begin to emulate, to mimic, and mirror the particular vision that we desire. Attracted by it and moved toward it, we begin to live into this vision of the good life and start to look like citizens who inhabit the world that we picture as the good life. We become little microcosms of that envisioned world as we try to embody it in the here and the now. This is to say that to be human is to desire the kingdom. Some version of the kingdom, which is the aim of our quest. However, to say that all humans desire the kingdom does not mean that we all desire the same kingdom. Structurally, we are lovers, and that love pump can be turned off, and because love is intentional and goal-oriented, our love is always aimed at some particular version of the good life that has been pictured for us. So according to James Smith, we are lovers, but our problem lies in the fact that we have misdirected loves, misdirected affections. Our affections in and of themselves aren't wrong. It's the object of our affections that are wrong. It is the picture that we have taken as the kingdom or the good life that we are pursuing. An incorrect picture that is wrong. It's the focus, not the desire. It's the issue we find Israel struggling with in the book we've been studying, the book of Hosea. Israel, the wife of Yahweh, has misplaced her affections. She loves the things that she has accrued. She's very happy about the way that the crops have flourished and about the riches and the fame. But her mistake is she thinks that the nations are the ones that have provided it for her. And because she loves these things, this idea of the good life, she pursues these nations and begins establishing covenants with these nations. She's pursuing these lovers because she really loves the stuff. I think of the election we're currently facing this week. We are presented with various pictures, various ideas of what the good life can be in America in the next 4 years. And if you want this particular vision of the good life in America, then what you need to do is to pursue this or pursue that person because they can provide you with this, or at least they, you know, it's campaign promises. So we say that. That might change after the election. But the promise is, trust in me, and I will give you the good life that I have presented you. Now, of course, we know there's only one good life. If we're looking at the correct picture, it's something that neither of these folks have the ability to achieve for us. And as those who are citizens in this world with our hearts trained toward the desire of the kingdom, our desire then is to see that manifested in the best way possible in the here and now as we wait the then and there that's going to come when He comes. So in the present, we make that decision. Israel is making that decision, and she's trying to secure it, not through the king on the throne. She's trying to pursue it through the nations that are around. They give her pictures of the good life. So if you covenant with us, we can provide for you. And the Lord has been pursuing her, but she is continuing on in this national adultery. And since she is refusing to return, she will not turn back from her harlotry, from her adultery. We saw the Lord is going to treat her then as an adulteress. He is going to judge her as an adulteress. The message of the book of Hosea, if through these 6 weeks that I've been planning to spend on this book, you get nothing else. Here's the nugget. Here's the message of the book. Although unfaithful Israel will return to the bondage of Egypt in Assyria, their faithful God will deliver them when their hearts return and seek Him and David their king. Unfaithful Israel is returning to the bondage of Egypt, this Gentile oppression, this times of the Gentiles we find out about in Daniel. They're returning to this subjugation to the nations, just like it was in Egypt, except it's not going to be Egypt this time. It's going to be Assyria. And they're going to be in that position until they return. Because their faithful God is waiting. He's waiting to deliver them. So when they return to Him, when they seek Him and David their king, He will restore. He will redeem. He will provide them with their status once again as His people. And they will rule the nations. That's what the book is about. That's its place and its contribution in the story. I mentioned previously the book has two major sections, chapters 1 through 3 and chapters 4 through 14. Chapters 1 through 3, we find that God is going to use the illustration of marriage to do just what that is supposed to do with a little twist. Right? Marriage is supposed to depict theologically the relationship between God and His people. But in this book, rather than presenting what should be, what ought to be, what will be, it presents what is. It's Hosea's marriage to this adulterous woman, Gomer, is presenting the unfaithful relationship that Israel is showing to their faithful God. So God's going to use chapters 1 through 3 to frame the discussion. And then in chapters 4 through 14, we're going to divorce court. He's going to take them in and explain, okay, so this is the situation and let me show you just how you're doing it. Just how you're guilty. The people are guilty. The priests are guilty. The kings and the princes are guilty. And he's going to lay out his case against them in chapters 4 through 14. Each of the two sections can be further divided, I believe, into three messages of judgment and hope. That's why I'm spending 6 weeks in it. I want to get our hands around the book, but we're doing it in the distinct messages within each section. So you got six total. In the previous weeks, we covered the first two. In chapters 1 and in chapters 2. It's that simple. Today we're going to look at the third and final message in the first section. You're going to find it in chapter 3. So if you would like to meet me there. It is a brief message. It's only 5 verses long, but it is a significant message. One that contributes to some of the most prophetically important passages in Scripture. Look at it with me if you will. Chapter 3 of Hosea. Verse 1. Then the Lord said to me, "Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer of barley and half of barley. Then I said to her, 'You shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So will I also be towards you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they will come trembling to the Lord and to His goodness in the last days.'" Now, I don't really care for the way that the New American Standard translates the first verse in this because it becomes confusing to me. What's going on here? Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel. I think In the prophetic books, especially when you go to Eugene Peterson and listen, look at his message that kind of condenses and gives you more the the feeling of it. Sometimes he gets it right, where even the more literal, we would say, translations gets it wrong. Listen to how he phrases it. "Then God ordered me, start all over. Love your wife again. Your wife who's in bed with her latest boyfriend. Your cheating wife. Love her the way that I, God, love the Israelite people. Even as they flirt and party with every god that takes their fancy." That's what's going on here. Is the Lord is coming to Hosea sometime between chapter 1 and chapter 3. Things have gotten so bad in his relationship with Gomer that now she's indebted and belongs to another man. So he's called to love his wife again, who is presently under the influence and apparently legal ownership of another man. Through debt, she's become his property. She sold herself into slavery. He's like a pimp, and now she's stuck there. And he's telling Hosea, get her back. Take her back. Now, we've mentioned before in probably previous sermons in Hosea that currently the divorce rate in America is 50%. And that's inside and outside the church. Doesn't matter. And I think that that's at least partly due to our understanding of the concept of love. The term love. You know, we use television, we use movies, we use romance novels like they're some kind of dictionary that we can go to and they can define this for us. You can tell me what love is. What is love? And if you go to those sources to try to get your definition, you're going to come away thinking that to love is synonymous with to want. To love means to feel like it. Okay, it's something we might think of more of an infatuation. It's something that I desire to do this because I feel like it. It feels good. I like it. I want it. So we're in this as long as we feel like it. Until the going gets rough. Right? Feeling, when the feeling's gone, you know, you lose that loving feeling and then you're gone. Gone, gone. Alright? I don't think I got to tell you that when God told Hosea here to go love his adulterous wife who is currently with another man, he's not really telling him to feel like it. To want to be in this relationship. Okay? He's telling him to do it, to go, to get to work, to set his affections to act on her behalf, to show her loyalty and sacrificial mercy because of their covenant bond. This is your woman. Go get her. Get to work. It's not that situation, you know, I can't make you love me if you don't. You can't make your heart feel something it won't. It's not about the feeling. It's about the action. This is the relationship you have entered into, and now you're acting on the basis of that relationship for her good. Go get her, whether you feel like it or not. Now, the word for love is used in a variety of ways, even in the first verse here. You know, you have Hosea, who is told to love his wife by his actions. Go get her. His wife is being loved by another. In this verse, you know, go love a woman who is loved by, and it's the NASB says husband. That's not it. It's her companion. It's this person that she's with. So go love the woman that's presently loved by another. And those two loves aren't the same. The way that Hosea is going to go show love, and we're going to find it's greatly at his cost for her benefit, is not the way that this fellow she's with is showing her love. That's more of an erotic love. Perhaps. Go love a woman that is being loved by another man, probably abused, even as then the Lord loves the sons of Israel. This is back again like Hosea. Though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. You know, they're loving the stuff over here. And the raisin cakes, it is stuff, but we're thinking of something that is involved in illicit worship practices. The raisin cakes are associated with that. So even as Israel loves to go play the harlot over here,
You go love them. You go love Gomer like the Lord is pursuing Israel despite the fact that she's doing this stuff. Okay? It's this covenant bond. Go act on it. So, verse 2, he says, I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. He buys her from her pimp. He redeems her. You know, when we use this word redemption, we normally think of New Testament ideas. Like the Lord redeemed us from sin. But really, this is, it's being used in a figurative sense, pointing back to how redemption is normally used. You know, redemption is the action of gaining or regaining a possession, something in exchange for a payment. I'm regaining something for a payment. I'm paying its cost. I'm clearing its debt. So it's figuratively used in the New Testament as to the Lord redeeming us from our bondage to sin through His sacrificial death. Hosea literally does this. The price he pays is very interesting. 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. This is an interesting sum for a couple reasons. The first goes back to the law. Listen to this. This is Exodus chapter 21, verse 32. We find that if an ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So you have this price of a slave that is, it's kind of like a damaged slave. There are various issues. This is like the covenant law. If you break your neighbor's property, you pay for it. Well, if the ox gores your neighbor's slave, you've broken their property. You pay for the property. How much does the property cost? 30 pieces of silver. 30 pieces. And that 30 pieces of silver is going to pop up throughout the story. I think of later one of the minor prophets, Zechariah. In Zechariah chapter 11, we'll have this to say. Zechariah is a funny fella. He has all kinds of visions and he plays all kinds of roles. Here he's role-playing Messiah in chapter 11. He's the shepherd of Israel and he's talking about these worthless sheep and how things are going with them. And this is what he's going to say in Zechariah chapter 11. He said, you know, the Lord says, my God, verse 4, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. This is God talking to the Messiah. Go pasture these perishing sheep of Israel. Those who buy them, slay them, and go unpunished. And each one of them who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I've become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them. Okay, this is, remember when Jesus is going and talking to the worthless shepherds of Israel. I'm the good shepherd, but look what you guys are doing. You're worthless. What ends up happening is he explains that he's going to break this covenant of care for them. He says, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. Verse 9, what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. Let those who are left eat one another's flesh. I took my staff of favor and I cut it in pieces to break my covenant, which I had made with all the peoples. Messiah comes and he's trying to show them grace and mercy, and they're rejecting him. So he says, okay, well, if you won't have me, the nations aren't going to treat you kindly. Okay, it's not going to go well for you. So it's broken on that day, and the afflicted of the flock were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. And I said to them, if it's good in your sight, this is Messiah, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So he took it and he throws it to the potter in the house of the Lord. So the Messiah comes to pasture the suffering sheep of Israel. They reject him. They don't value him any more than a gored slave. Than a slave. 30 pieces of silver. And so he throws it to the house of the potter. Now, of course, you know in the New Testament, we find the Messiah is betrayed. This is Matthew 26. Judas comes and he turns over Jesus. Now, he doesn't think they're going to convict and kill him, but that's what they end up doing. So we find in Matthew chapter 26, verse 14, one of the 12 named Judas went to the chief priest and said, what are you willing to give me to betray him to you, Jesus? They weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him. Then he began looking for a way to betray him. Here's the price of a slave. Okay, I'll go betray him. He goes and does that. Then what happens? Chapter 27, morning came and the chief priests and elders conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. They bound him, led him away, delivered him to Pilate the governor. And when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse, returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I've sinned, betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What's that to us? See to it yourself." And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary. He goes away. He ends up hanging himself. And what the chief priests do with it is they conferred together, verse 7, with the money and bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. So it's called the field of blood. So you got the 30 pieces of silver. It's the worthless price you pay for a slave that Zechariah says they don't even value Messiah as much as a slave. It's 30 pieces of silver, so he's going to toss it in the potter's house. New Testament, here comes Messiah, betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, price of a slave, and the money's thrown into the potter's field. Here in Hosea, 15 pieces of silver, a homer and a half of barley. You say, well, 15 and 30, there's a pretty big difference there, about 50%. Why is that? Are we talking about the same thing? How do we know? Well, the issue, the distinction in Hosea and these other passages is that Hosea doesn't have enough cash. He doesn't have enough. He's haggling for his wife's release. He's paying. It's kind of like a poker table, you know, when the price gets raised too much and you want something, but you can't stay in the game. So you're taking off your watch. You're taking off your ring. The Lord says, go get the woman back. So he gives everything he has. It's not enough. So he has to take from his other materials to sacrificially buy this woman back. That's the difference. A homer and a half is 15 shekels. So you got the 30 shekels. He buys her back. He redeems this woman at his cost for her benefit. When does he redeem her? Is it after she returns? He redeems her without being asked, without her wanting him, without her having anything to do with him. While she's his enemy, he goes, he redeems her, he brings her back to her place, and he says to her, "You shall stay with me," verse 3, "for many days. You shall not play the harlot, you shall not have a man, and so I will also be towards you." So he goes to this woman who is his enemy, and while she is his enemy, he redeems her, brings her back, but he doesn't return to their normal relationship. They don't have this husband-wife relationship immediately. They don't have this conjugal relationship. Not immediately. Why? She is his wife. I initially thought this had more to do with reconsecration. I was thinking that, you know, and it may to some extent, they are going into a period of celibacy before they re-enter into a monogamous relationship. So I was thinking, is he trying to purify her? What's, you know, or is he trying to punish her, maybe? You've done this, so this is it. I don't think that's it. I think something else is the focus here. And I think the text will tell us it's relational. There's a relational issue at play. Notice the parallel, verse 4. "For the sons of Israel will remain many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. Afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They'll come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days." So I ask, what's the purpose for the pause? What's the cause for the delay? You know, what's holding this love train up? What's the issue in their relationship? I don't think Hosea is punishing Gomer. I don't think he's purifying Gomer. Not primarily. I think what he's doing is he's waiting for Gomer. He's brought her back, and now he's waiting on her. He's not forcing himself on Gomer. He's not treating her like she is property. He's waiting for her to return his affection. He's waiting for her
to seek Him and His goodness. He's brought her out of the pit of despair under this pimp or whatever he is as a slave. And he does everything he can to put a hedge of protection around her, get her back, restore her. He's got her ready. It's ready. It's all ready. But he's not going to force it upon her. He brings her back and then he waits. He waits for her to seek him. And that's exactly what we find God is going to do with the nation of Israel. Verse 4. The sons of Israel are going to remain many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. You know, we got that election coming up. It'd be like saying, the days are coming where there's not going to be a president. There's not even going to be parties. No candidates. They gone. No churches. Or if you're in the Roman Empire, there's not going to be an emperor. There's not going to be a dynasty. There's not going to be a pope. You're not even going to have little icons at the house anymore. It's all gone. And it's going to be that way for a long time, for many days. Until when? Until you return. Until you set your affections back on the Lord, His ways, His kingdom. When you return, when you seek Him and seek David your king, which is the king of Judah, by the way. Remember, this is a message to the northern kingdom of Israel with their false kings, their false priesthood, all that. It says, when you get your affections set correctly, you know, when your heart's pointing north again, the compass of your heart, when you're looking for God and His Messiah, then you're restored. Then I will return you. Then I'll have compassion on you as at the beginning. Then we'll set off this Deuteronomy 30 clock, and it's all going to go back to the way that it was. But you'll never be taken away again. That's what I think is going on here. Now, it is interesting in verse 4. We're going to have a lot more to say about this. I'm waiting until next week to really unpack it. But he says they'll be without king or prince, so you don't have a regent, you don't have a dynasty or any heir to the throne. You're going to be without sacrifice or sacred pillar. You don't have any temple or objects of worship. But it also says without ephod or household idols. And the interesting thing about that, I've mentioned before, we've got a couple major passages that are in the background in Hosea. One is going to be the Exodus, right? Whenever it's going to be Exodus 32 through 34. So you got the issue with the golden calf. You got Moses jumping on the hand grenade, trying to keep, you know, the Lord says, I'm going to wipe them out. I'm not going to go with them in the land. He says, you got to go, Lord. You got all that in the background. He says, not going to show compassion. Okay, I'll show compassion. All that. But the next thing that's going to start popping up actually comes from the book of Judges. It's going to be, you might recall the way that the narrative plays out. Is the Lord provides the nation with various leadership to restrain evil and promote righteousness in the people. Judges, priests, kings, prophets. That's the order in the story. The judges show up, they fail. The priests show up, they fail. The kings show up, they fail. And now, right here, the prophets are showing up to talk sense into the people. They're going to fail too. Okay? But in the judges portion, after the judges fail, you know, you have these cycles in judges and things just get worse and worse. The priests show up, and the first thing they do is they set up, well, we find a false priesthood is set up. You got this guy, Micah, he has his own priest in his house. He has his own ephod in his own household idols, and he sets up this false, this illicit priesthood and illicit forms of worship. The same thing that the northern kingdom is doing. And then next week, we're going to find that just as the priests had Sodom and Gomorrah going on in the land, that's what's going on. That's a similar thing's going to happen in Hosea 2. So that's what I think he's talking about, is not only are you not going to have kings or priests, not only is the temple going to be gone, so I mean Jerusalem, it's not looking good for you either down in the south, but even this illicit priesthood thing you got going on, all of it, real and fake, I'm going to completely cure you guys of any false hope, any false desire, any false picture of the kingdom. Not these kings, not this worship. It's not a golden calf. It's none of that. It's God and His son David. That's it. And whenever they finally realize that, they will return. They will seek their God and David their king. And it's not going to happen until the last days. Now this is interesting. We've talked about last week, before Jeremiah 31, there was
Hosea chapter 2, where he says, I'm going to put my character in you guys and you will know me. So before the new covenant that we're all familiar with, Hosea says, I was telling you guys it's going to happen. Now in Hosea chapter 3, this is before Daniel. This is before Romans chapter 9 through 11. It's after Deuteronomy 32. But we're still talking about the same thing, and the key word is delay. It's going to be a delay. There's going to be a period where Israel is put on the sidelines. They're not going to have king, prince, temple, none of that. They're going to reject God. They're going to reject his king. And because they're going out to the nations, looking to them for the good stuff, God's eventually going to set them aside for a period. And it's going to be many days until the program is picked up and they return and seek his goodness in the last day. So this is Daniel chapter 9, before Daniel chapter 9. Okay, this is Rome. This is its contribution. When Paul's trying to say, look guys, I don't hate Israel. I'm trying to make them jealous. I'm trying to explain to y'all that through God's program, it's the bringing in of the nations that is going to result in the return of Israel. And that's how I'm fitting into this thing. He's saying, read the Old Testament, because that's what it's about. That's what God told. He told him way before it happened, this is where the story's going. So I look at this. I look at its contribution, not just to Hosea, but also to the biblical narrative and to us as we're looking in. Because remember, the postscript in the book says, one, Ephraim, northern kingdom, you need to figure out it's not about idols. God is your help. But for us, the reader, we're looking at the Father and his faithfulness, and we're supposed to be spurred then by his character to respond in kind, right, in this monogamous way towards him. So I say, what can we learn from a chapter such as this? Which leads me to the question we began with, which is, who are we? Who are we? And I think that Mr. Smith is correct, that we are what we love, but love isn't just a desire. It is a decision. The book of Hosea presents love as a decision. It is chesed. We've talked about chesed before as sacrificial mercy, and it is. But there's a broader dimension with that. It's not just that, it's covenant loyalty, covenant fidelity. That's why the New American Standard is going to render Hosea 6:6 as loyalty. God says, I delight in chesed, in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offering. He said, the point is this fidelity. It is this love relationship that is for the benefit of your partner at your cost. When you're looking at this, I think that many times I've even described the prophets as covenant enforcers. Covenant enforcers, right? They're coming with Deuteronomy 28. They're saying, you've done this, so this is happening. Or you're wondering why there's a famine in the land. Take a big guess, guys. Look what you're doing. So return. And I think that that's true, but I think that there's a deeper level we need to look at, and it directly relates to this book. It's not just that they are covenant enforcers. I think to think about that is to kind of think of the Pharisees a little bit, right? If we're rich, we must be keeping the covenant, right? If we have this, then God must be pleased with us, and vice versa. If you're getting hit, God must not be pleased. It's not just that they're covenant enforcers. More fundamentally, they are character enforcers. They're not just going to talk to Israel, by the way. The prophets are going to talk to the nations. The nations don't have a covenant with God. They are character enforcers. And they're coming in and explaining how the heart of God is not being represented in the people he has created to serve, love, and represent him. So as we come to this and look, and we recognize who we are in him, that we are what we love, but love just isn't just a feel-like-it kind of thing. It's a decision that you make to set your affections on something, even when it's not to your immediate benefit that you can see, even when it hurts, even when it costs you all the cash you got in the bank and then some, like Hosea. It is a self-giving for the benefit of one another, for the benefit of the neighbor, and as an affection of trust to God that he ultimately is the one providing and caring for us. It's monogamy, it's love, it's trust. That's the character of God in the book of Hosea. And I think that's what he expects from us today.